Take a journey through history with a new podcast from St. Luke's Historic Church and Museum, hosted by me, John Erickson. Join the conversation with scholars and historians as we tackle subjects like race, women's history, and constitutional law. Explore how the pursuit of religious freedom in colonial America has shaped our modern life. Tune in to History from the Old Brick Church podcast today, available on all major podcast platforms.
Are you craving discussions about the past without the ego? You're in the right spot. Here, humility and engaging conversations reign supreme. These are stories that leave a mark. This is the Tattooed Historian Show. You all know me by now. I love comparative history. I love history that's transnational, that makes us think about the larger picture, allows us to see the rhymes of history. And I was so glad to get a copy of The Civil War in the Age of Nationalism, brought out by LSU Press, written by Niels Eichhorn and Duncan A. Campbell. It is a tremendous resource that talks about things going on around the world in the Civil War era. So things from the early 1800s, going through the revolutions of 1848, going into the Civil War era, and then beyond concerning Reconstruction and memory. It's just a fascinating book, and I was so happy to have the chance to sit down and talk with these two guys about it. You're going to really enjoy this particular interview because there's a lot going on. We talk a lot about the bigger issues. You know, we don't get really deep into the weeds because we want you to pick this book up and to learn something from it. But there are issues facing or concerning nationalism, secession, what is modern war, some issues of historical memory and monuments, and even more. So it's a great discussion, a great way to open the discussion for you to take into the book and to understand this even more. It is a fantastic resource, and I'm so thankful to LSU Press for getting me what is probably the first copy in Canada. Really happy about that, and I'm really happy that you've tuned in to this episode of the Tattooed Historian Show. Enjoy our conversation, and don't forget to slap that subscribe button. I would greatly appreciate it. Well, guys, it is great to see both of you. I'm really excited to talk about your new book, The Civil War in the Age of Nationalism. I got the book right here. I think I had the first one in Canada, so I'm really excited about that. Niels and Duncan, it's so great to have you on. And we have an international component to our interview because Niels is in Austria and Duncan's in the U.S. and I'm in Canada. So kind of bringing the book to life in a different way, right?
Totally.
Some of you who are watching my production or listening on the podcast have heard Niels before and making a return to the Tattooed Historian project once again. This is Duncan's first time on, and I'm really happy to have you on, Duncan. Duncan, I would love to start with you since Niels has already had an opportunity to be on once before. I would love to start with you since you are the newest member of this kind of little club that we have going on here. For you, Duncan, I would love to hear about your previous experience with being educated as someone who enjoys history. What was the spark for you for history, and how did you use that through your educational process?
What's interesting for me is I learned very quickly that history is about interpretation. My mother's English, my father's Scottish. And so British history, it's quite different depending on which one of them is telling it. So you could say from childhood, I learned very quickly that, you know, history involves interpretation, quite generous interpretations at times. More seriously, though, I kind of had a very childhood in that I grew up in the UK, South Africa, or Southern Africa, and Canada. So I also got introduced to lots of different nations. My father worked for the United Nations. So I got introduced to a lot of different countries' histories and stories. You know, this is a childhood. And one of my favorite memories is still my old headmaster, John Forbes, who was a World War II veteran who served in Italy. And he used to tell us war stories. And I mean, this was before junior high. And he used to bang the table for emphasis, particularly when artillery was firing. So it's kind of interesting getting all of this sort of in your childhood, all these stories and these perspectives. So it was interesting. I actually, in university, thought I was going to go into literature. But I actually just found history more compelling in the end, so I switched away. But I've still got, as you probably guessed from the book, I still have great interest in literature. Because in some ways, literature is historical in the sense that it comes from other cultures, usually talks about certain periods and so forth. So there's that element to it as well. So I've never really given up my love of literature, but I've more or less become a professional historian. Consequent of, early childhood and growing up. It's just that line by Faulkner, you know, history isn't dead. It's not even past. You keep getting this. It's just been my life experience. So I've always enjoyed it. And at university, I just became genuinely interested in it because you learned, you know, unlike in high school, where you just get this textbook, you really do start digging in the sources and so on. And I just became fascinated by it. So that's really what's, I guess, I wouldn't say I was a born historian, but pretty much I was pushed in this direction just by, my upbringing, I would say.
Well, I was a 70% average student in literature, so it had to be history for me. I don't know why it just didn't stick. I love it though, but
theory really.
Niels, how about you, my friend? It's great to see you again, obviously. And what about that for anyone who hasn't heard your interpretation, basically, if we want to stick with interpretation, of where that spark started for you, where you wanted to learn history or where you wanted to go down that route of learning history?
It's a great question, and it's good to be back, John, and seeing you again and being here with Duncan today. I guess my first suggestion would be to watch my other interview with John. It's still out there in the live streams that he has on YouTube. But I did not have that fond upbringing that Duncan had. That my parents were definitely not sort of so read, the history focused, the very intellectual types that I can tell. And I grew up with the wonderful racism of Karl Mises history books / travel novels / problems that it has. And I recently remembered actually being in Bad Segeberg for the last performances that Pierre Brice put on as Winnetou, the Native American white guy performing a Native American. And there actually was a white guy in blackface performing a role too. So I was like recently thinking, oh, good God. What was that like? For me, it really started with Gettysburg's a Movie, which is quite ironic considering my opinions these days about the battlefield and Gettysburg and everything surrounding it. But it really, for me, it started with Terry Beckenbaugh's Civil War class as a freshman when it was fascinating. He was like, oh, you need to write a research paper. And I was like, I don't know. I've never done a research paper. What should I think about? And I stumbled on German-American relations and built from there. And it kind of like, yes, we're not doing diplomatic history in this book, or I haven't returned to those roots yet, but I definitely want to eventually kind of address that larger frame. But, you know, it's, I think as Duncan kind of already indicated, growing up in another country, coming to the United States, it gives us a very different perspective on a lot of things. And that's what I really enjoyed working with Duncan on with regard to the book, because we both come from very different backgrounds and we never had a fight, you know? We never fought over what goes into the book.
That said, I still think it's a Franco-Prussian war. I mean, I just, you know.
No. I will boil a book to prove it.
Don't get me started on the Prussians this early in the conversation. Yeah. was that, for either of you, was that possibly a little bit shocking when you came to these sites of trauma and the American Civil War and stuff, and it seemed like it was in a vacuum? The American perception in many cases is this is just in one kind of tunnel, and this is all by itself, and this is the real first of so many other things, when in actuality it's not. Was that something that surprised you in a way, or was that just kind of the quintessential nationalistic idea of we did it first, or we did it the best, or it was the worst? What are your thoughts on that when you first kind of came into that?
This is just my perspective. It's mm-hmm. coming from a British background. When I started doing British history as a child, what we used to get was our island story. Mm-hmm. Europe played no role in British history, apparently, after pretty much the Tudors. Mm-hmm. That's changed dramatically in the intervening years. So this idea of just national exceptionalism and just being in a silo of your own nation state, it's not as if American historians or Americans are the only people who do this. Most history programs today are still national based. So most historians do tend to focus strictly on the nation state and don't really do that much comparative history. So it's a question of, I think it's more or less still just professional in all countries still do tend to focus on the nation state. I do think that's changing though. And we acknowledged in the beginning, Carl Daigler, in a lot of ways, for me at least, sparked my interest in pursuing this project with his essay on, One Among Many, making the point that a lot of things going on in America are being replicated elsewhere at the same time. And this is, I think, it's still, I think, still an issue, but I think more historians are starting to say, yeah, wait a minute, you can't just stay with the nation state. We've got to start looking at the nation within the context of the wider world, whether regional, just in the case of the Americas, or the West pulling Europe, or just globally looking, elsewhere. So that would be my take on it.
Yeah, I kind of thinking back to moments there in the British archives and Kew Gardens when I requested correspondence from London, from Paris going to London. And I don't know who it was, but there were still copy slips where a person had requested certain pages being photocopied for some. And it was literally every time Lord Cowley wrote about the United States. And then it was fascinating just to look at he writes about the United States. Oh, on the same day, he writes this letter about issues in Italy. Oh, there's another letter about same day issues in Germany. And you had some days there were seven letters that he wrote. Each of them was a different subject. And it was sort of this, for me, that was really the big wake up call, seeing somebody's research methodology and seeing the sort of I don't care about the rest. I only care about this topic, and I'm only going to look at this topic. And it was sort of that's not how Cowley operated. That's not how Palmerston or Russell or anybody in the world operated at this time. So kind of, that's not how we operate, right? For us, we're thinking about Israel, about Ukraine, about Iran, about politics in Washington at the same time. We're not thinking compartmentalized. So for the next hour, I think, and for the hour after that, Palestine, and then I think about maybe the European Union, and then China. We don't do that, do we? So I think that, for me, was always this big moment where I was like, why don't you? Why don't you try to understand this time period? Yes, I get it. It's a lot more work. But it cohesively, as a whole, it's... and I'm probably more of the pessimist than Duncan. I'm not quite sure yet we're quite out of the nationalist frame of mind, but I hope he's right.
It was interesting growing up and not understanding the totality of the worldwide impact of revolutions in the mid-19th century, previous revolutions as well, 1848, obviously, and Franco-Prussian War and things like that. And being constantly told that, you know, this is the first modern war, the American Civil War is, and this is X, Y, Z. When you both pointed out in the book that, you know, this is a series of really interesting revolutions / civil wars that are going on. And it just so happens that at that moment in time on that continent, perhaps that's the most modern thing, war going on. But other things are happening around the globe because that's the way the world works. Like you say, Niels, we're thinking about six countries in a day. What is happening in this region, et cetera, et cetera. So it's just natural, right?
Yeah. Like I just saw, I think it was this morning or yesterday, I saw a post by this Civil War author on Instagram where she's like, goes, Battle of Hampton Roads, the kind of naval battle that changes everything. And I commented on it. I was like, no, this is not the first battle of an ironclad against wooden warships. That goes to the Nemesis. It's iron on iron. Yes, that's the first time. But I think that's, I don't think a lot of people know about there being a naval battle that involved an iron vessel in the Opium War. But there's, during the Crimean War, we have evidence of French ironclad batteries being used against Russian naval positions in Sevastopol. So it's this moment where you're like, you're so narrowly nation state focused sometimes, and the books have so long told you this is the groundbreaking moment where everything changes, and we're kind of saying, no, there's more to this.
Yeah, but it's also bizarre because we know if you actually, you say, like, let's just take Abraham Lincoln, okay? Abraham Lincoln was not parochial. He was he got caught up in the Louis Kossuth phenomena. When Louis Kossuth comes to the United States, Lincoln's an admirer. You know, according to one historian, he buys a so-called Kossuth hat and starts wearing it when he's giving public speeches. So I mean, Americans at the time are aware of the wider world. And Louis Kossuth does represent in his speeches and also discussions amongst Americans and others, new ideas about the nation state that very definitely have applicability to the United States. Is this a union or is it a nation? These ideas are going through Lincoln's minds, are going through Americans' minds. They are not existing in this purely American world where the rest of the world doesn't exist. I mean, especially not if you think about the amount of immigration that's taking place at this time in the United States with the know-nothings and whatnot. These are not a particularly parochial people. They are aware of the wider world and wider goings on in its shapes. I mean, in our book, we make the note that, you know, part of the Gettysburg Address, you know, government over the people, for people, by the people, may come from Kossuth. There's a direct possibility Lincoln lifted that from Kossuth, which, by the way, that's normal. People always do this. But it's this sense that there you go. There's a bit of Hungarian in the Gettysburg Address. And it's just, again, should remind you that this is really a interconnected global world. People of the time are aware of this. They're, you know, literate, the educated, and that's actually most, certainly white Americans, actually can read and write at this point, and they are aware of this stuff. They aren't necessarily foreign policy mavens, but they know about the wider world. And this is true for other people as well. So it's a bit surprising when this just sort of gets, as Neil says, just gets jettisoned. And it's just not in the story, even though it would have been very much part of the story for these people when they were alive and doing their stuff.
We often talk a lot about the immigrants from Europe who come and to the United States in the 1850s, 1860s, who later serve in the American Civil War and such. But we don't always understand why they came. It was just one of these issues of, oh, there were a lot of Germanic state immigrants who came here at the time and settled and became, you know, soldiers or were taking part in politics of that era. But we often don't realize why they came here in the first place. And I think that's one of the strengths of your book as well, is because you're showcasing these ideas that are being spread throughout Europe and the rest of the world, where maybe it would cause people to say, you know, I don't want to stick around for this. I don't want to be involved in another, you know, a political fight or a physical fight or another war. I'm going to go somewhere else, whether it's the United States or Canada or you know, China even. It's just, I'm going to get the heck out of here and move on. And that rise of immigration that we see in mid-19th century has a cause to that, right? And I think sometimes we lose that when we discuss immigrants fighting in the Civil War or something to that effect. What was really some of the big things that are churning in Europe in the 1840s? What are some of those ideas that are, you know, being passed around about nation or freedom or, you know, even religion at that time that you wanted to really highlight in the book to get that point across? Niels, you want to take it away first?
Sure. All right, you know, we could spend an hour on that, right? Because there's so much. But
yeah,
I think the big part that we always have to remember, and it sort of goes with primarily the first two chapters of the book, that fragility and lack of definition of the nation state, you know, it's like, and that's the same for most of the book, that even by the end of the 19th century, when you look anywhere, it's still not 100% clear. What does it mean to be German? What does it mean to be Peruvian, Italian, French? You know, it's like even the French, we think of, oh, it's they all speak French. No, they didn't. They all spoke different dialects. They all had their own kind of regionalisms. Mm-hmm. So I think that's sort of the big factor to consider. And it's the same in the United States. Are you, as a person in South Carolina, first and foremost a South Carolinian, or are you a person from the United States? Mm-hmm. And that's the same question Hungarians ask. Mm-hmm. Am I Hungarian first, or am I part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire? And for a lot of people, that it creates an identity crisis, right? Who am I? What country do I belong to? What group do I belong to? We're all group people. We all want to be part of something. And if you don't know what you're belonging to, it makes life a lot more difficult, because you kind of, like, you're swimming in a stream without kind of anything to grab on, or there's so much to grab on that you don't know, ooh, that looks nice, or that looks nice, and I don't know which one I should take. So for me, it was, and that, again, it cuts so many directions. Like, it's the unification movements that we get. Like, you can look at it in the United States as such. You can look at it as the separatism movement that we get in South Carolina and get in Hungary and other places. It's like the imagining of the national community is just not there yet. It's still in the process. And that, I think, is for a lot of people the most difficult.
Now, I just say the divisions are what always strike me with the nation states, because even again, we go back to the US. The South is not a unified bloc. Quite apart from the African Americans, you have large numbers of Southern Unionists. Then in the North, there's plenty of Copperheads who, you know, do not actually support the Union war effort. And so this whole, you know, it's, you're talking about North versus South. Well, it's actually several Norths and several Souths. And it's the same with nations in Europe and elsewhere. There isn't really, you've got, you know, Britain consists of various different peoples. And they don't necessarily get along and don't agree on the national destiny. It's and this is true of Hungary, and it's true of Russia, and it's true of a lot of places. And as Neil says, it's very true of Germany too.
Yeah, it's fine. That idea of identity, you know, we still see it today when borders are drawn after Versailles, or borders are drawn after the Second World War, and people are saying, well, I don't really fit into this enclave you've put me in, culturally or religiously or whatever the case may be. I don't fit into that. We still have these kinds of ideas that are being passed around when someone doesn't feel like home is home anymore, or whatever the case may be. This is the human experience, right? Where we can understand what someone from the 1840s was going through to that point. It's a very small point because their life is different in many ways. But just that idea of, do I really fit in here, or do I need to exit? Do I need to revolt in some way? Right.
Well, you know, that in part strikes very personal because my mother's side of the family is from East Prussia, which at the end of the Second World War became Polish. So my parents had my grandmother and grandfather, technically only my grandmother because he was in Siberia, had to flee into what then becomes the GDR. And then they fled out of the GDR into West Germany. So it's a very, very tough process to kind of, like, immigration is always difficult because you take everything and you run. But I think the other part that I hope comes out nicely in the book, that's sort of up to the reader, I suppose, is that imagining process, you know, that I found, even though it's not the longest of chapters, Duncan takes the crown on the longest chapter, I think, in the book with the first one. But I think the memory chapter was just fascinating to think about, because that, how do we imagine the community, right? Like, we do it in history books, but we also do it with statues, with monuments, with celebrations for veterans in the nation. And just seeing how in the second half, the last quarter of the 19th century, all of these states around the world, primarily around the Atlantic, just start like putting all these festivities on, putting up monuments, and just to kind of be like, no, it's not just in the US where we do all this monumentation. Everyone does it because they all want to figure out, how do we define that nation state? How do we communicate that to the masses and kind of create finally that imagined community for everyone?
Another aspect I do want to highlight as well is, Niels knows this because I've said this, I don't think I ever quite got this exactly the way I wanted to, was the staggering impact of religion in this period. Because there's always this kind of church and state, you know, religion is there, you know, it's a separate, completely separate area. If you deal with that, you're a theologian. And this is an insanely religious century. It's amazing how religion permeates every single debate. And the fact the US has an effective Kulturkampf against Roman Catholics, the way that Germany does or Prussia does with Bismarck, and of course Grant celebrates this, you know, Grant's a former know-nothing, applauds this going on in Germany, which is again, people paying attention to what's going on abroad. The fact that religion is this incredibly powerful marker and permeates a language. And it, as I say, it really doesn't matter whether you're religious or irreligious. You just can't get away from this shared religious controversy that's running through the 19th century. And the fact that, for instance, Napoleon III's wife, Eugenie, sees his intervention in Mexico as protecting Catholic people against rapacious Protestants, i.e. the United States, that's a completely different view to Napoleon's involvement in Mexico than I'd ever considered until I came across, you know, Eugenie's defense of it. Mm-hmm. It's just the way that this impulse is going, that's also global, this surge of religion. I also found that interesting. This was transnational, and you could find it everywhere. So it's another area where people, which is sort of, again, it seems to be sort of, I don't say it doesn't, obviously 19th century historians are aware of it, but it never really seems to get the attention it deserves. And it is there, it's a vital impulse in people's lives. And even if some of these people in here we look at, like Palmerston and possibly Lincoln, don't necessarily believe in this, they nonetheless have to make genuflection towards it because they are dealing with cultures, wider national cultures that are very much religious. So you do need to, you know, make sure you reflect that in some way or another in your public speeches and addresses.
Yeah, that really struck me as interesting too, Duncan, because of the fact of, you know, we're just coming off of the Second Enlightenment, if you will, and now we're starting to come back around to something a little bit more, dare I say, in the words, traditional, quote unquote, where they're picking up this mantle of religiosity, if you will, you know, going back to something where there must be a higher power that's involved in this, or we have to save these people from, you know, the wrong higher power or the wrong, belief system. And that comes up time and again, right? It's one of these issues that is, it just keeps repeating. It's a rhyme of history where we hear constantly, oh, that's the way they feel in their religion and it's not correct. And we must go out there and show them the way, quote unquote. And it keeps happening. Yeah. It's another issue of comparative history that I love, where that's what this book is, really, is a comparative interdisciplinary history of this era.
You want to say more, Duncan? You know, it's like the religion was your field.
No, I just say, just away from religion, though, but also this goes into another area about nation building. A lot of it's imperialism as well. That creations of nation states almost inevitably involve, you know, exploiting others. It's this is why we look at the Maori in New Zealand, what Britain's doing there. We compare what's going on the Dakota and the Sioux. I mean, as it's clear, the Dakota, the Zulus and the Dakota. I mean, it's just these imperial frontiers are another important shaping of everybody's minds. And what's interesting, it's my frontier. You're not just dealing with the indigenous peoples. You're also dealing with rival imperial powers. And your imperialism is almost better, is always better than their imperialism. This comparative imperialism is another point I want people to take away from the book, because there is a lot of this self-righteousness attached to it, that we're the ones bringing civilization, those chaps are bringing darkness, even though fundamentally when you look at what they're doing, they are doing the same thing. If you're seeing this from the indigenous point of view, there is actually no real benefit dealing with the Americans or the British. You are dealing with pretty much a similar worldview, respecting you and your place in the world, which very often means you have no place in it, or you've got a much reduced place in it. And it's this too is something we want to get across, because this is another thing that's common to certainly all the European or European derived societies at this point. And I just want to, Niels deserves real credit for this, because this is also a real issue in Latin America, which I'm very happy we've kind of pulled this into the book, because Latin America tends to be, doesn't seem to get the attention it should, even though, and I'm going to let Niels talk, I think some of the aspects the U.S. follows are actually much closer to Latin America than in Europe. In some ways, the U.S. is in this kind of strange hybrid position where it behaves more like a Latin American nation than a European one. In other ways, more European than Latin American. But I'm going to let Niels talk about this, because he's really the expert rather than me.
I'm not sure I'm the expert on that.
More so than me.
But I was thinking when you saw the book, but I also think, saw when you were saying about like imperialism and religion being so closely connected, of like it's like, I think it's only a paragraph really in the religion chapters that we did, where it's like the Mount Lebanon civil war in what's modern day Lebanon and Syria, you know, and like it's Christians against Muslims that you have. And then even though the authorities are pretty much quelling it, you all of a sudden have Napoleon III pictured down there in the corner going like, you know, I should go in there as a peacekeeper. And everyone knew this is just him trying to find a way to take over territory. And that's like when afterwards he was like, you know, I should stay a little bit longer, you know, just to make sure. And everyone in Europe, like, no, you're going to leave now. There's nothing to be done here anymore. And, you know, I think that's where one of the hardest parts sometimes to keep the thematic approach to the book, because you so often were like, but it also fits there and also fits here and fits there. And, I some readers will probably be sick of hearing about Otto von Bismarck or Napoleon or some of the individuals that are very prominent in the book, but it just was very hard to kind of be like, you know, where do we put all these different characters, these stories mm-hmm. that are going on at the same time?
And as we said before we went live, my family is not a fan of Bismarck, but that's a whole other live stream because, we spoke Low German and they were the High Germans. And we're like, no, we don't want anything to do with you. But again, going back to this idea of nation and what an identity is, you go talk to a Bavarian in the 19th century, they're going to say something totally different than someone maybe in East Prussia or something. That identity crisis sometimes continues through family lineage too, because I heard the same thing. We're not Prussian, we're Bavarian. And it's still like we're talking about North versus South. We're talking about, a South Carolinian versus a Pennsylvanian. Well, we're putting them into these generic lumps of they must have thought this way because they were from this state.
Yeah.
And as you point out, and as others have pointed out for just on the American side of things, that's not true. And that whole generalizations don't work in many cases.
Yeah, I think that's a pitfall of the book, right? Like you want to be more nuanced, but you can't.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I just said it's interesting how national identities are actually very much enforced much of the time. It's not always just a choice. You very often, if you oppose German unification, for instance, you are just out of luck. If you didn't support the way, the United States, the direction the United States went in, leave slavery aside, just the idea of the federal government acquiring these powers, you're out of luck. If you're Irish and didn't want to be tied into a tight British unified state, you're out of luck. And this is the other thing with this nationalism also comes these large conscript armies, which can actually much impose their will very effectively on people. And this is another aspect. This is something that didn't really exist at the time of the American Revolution or earlier periods, where you really had much smaller professional forces or levies raised for a specific time. This period is where it's not just that the armies are mass, you've got mass conscription for armies, but you've got mass conscription for culture as well. And this is the consequence of the industrialization and so on that's taking place. It's actually a very different world. The 19th century was gone before. And in some ways, we're still living in it, this, mass media, mass communication and stuff, which is absolutely vital to create a nation state. I don't see how you can do it without it. And this goes now, like we talk about the southern states, is it the American South, for instance? It's filled with strip malls and whatnot, like the rest of the United States. Regional identities are nothing like as strong as they used to be. So this is the nation state and nationalization is still going on. It's not a process that ended. We're still going on with it. John, you wanted to say something.
Oh, I was thinking about your talking point about standing armies and this idea of, large standing armies being able to impose their will, et cetera. And we know that many of the early Americans said, absolutely not. We don't want this. We don't want a large standing army. They basically after the Civil War, they defunded much of the army and the Reconstruction Army was a lot weaker than the antebellum army. And the idea of the citizen soldier is kind of the epitome of patriotism in that way, because it's the Union Army or et cetera, instead of the U.S. Army. Was that similar around other parts of the world too, going on where they're saying we don't, certain members of the population, even if they agree with the nation state, are still kind of apprehensive about these large military forces because they can perceive that as if something happens we don't like from the government, they can impose it through the use of force by a large standing army. Is that kind of a similar vein outside of America at this time?
Yeah, the hostility to the large standing army, to an extent, the Americans inherited that from Britain. This was always an argument in Britain, no large standing armies. Mm-hmm. And actually, it's not until the First World War that you have proper conscription in Britain. Canada's similar, Australia and New Zealand are similar. European continent is slightly different. Generally, it's argued the French Revolution is the first mass modern conscript army. And it starts becoming more popular in the European continent. But in the English-speaking world, I use that term biasly, like one of the reasons the British police, the Metropolitan Police, London Police are unarmed is because Robert Peel, the British Prime Minister, was reacting to this idea this cannot be a paramilitary force operating in a civilian capacity. So there's the fear of large standing armies is there. But interestingly enough, when the pedal hits the metal, the United States goes with large standing armies, conscript armies, most recently in Vietnam. Yeah. Britain goes with conscript armies as well, first and second world war. So this tradition, we don't have large standing armies. Normally you don't, but actually you do if you need them. Conscription is going to come, and it does. For the draft is called.
Yeah. There's also a lot of money in a large standing army.
I think you're totally right. It is more of the Anglo-American tradition to have small armies because they're safer. I'm still like, we didn't put it much into the book. Maybe eventually when I get time for a Latin America study, it doesn't seem like Latin America has very large armies. I think in part that's because the underfunding of the state institutions is just a reality. And you have so many kind of warlord type individuals, caudillos, that are kind of like, I have my little armies. There's a little army. I recruit in my province. This guy recruits in their province. And it's there's not a huge group of people that then gets together. Like, we're not seeing like 10,000, 50,000 men troops as a result. That said, I mean, on the continent, it's just we're already seeing, and it caused a lot of issues in the relationships between the United States and, say, France, Prussia, Austria, where, like, who are you part of? Does your subjecthood to Prussia end when you become citizen of the United States? Does that mean your conscription service does not need to take place anymore? That were big issues that come with the nation state of, like, who belongs? How long do you belong, right? Like, as a naturalized U.S. citizen and a citizen of Germany, it's that big question that my son and I potentially will eventually face, you know, when, like Duncan kind of says, when things get ugly, well, who do you side with? Whose nationality do you pick up on? Like, but I think that's part of this interesting dilemma that that we saw in the military chapters, that it just seeing, like, yes, we all know the casualty figures for the United States, and it's staggering. But then when you look at just sort of in timely comparison, the numbers for, like, the Crimean War or the the Franco-German War or the German-German War, I mean, those numbers are just even worse. Everyone in the U.S. is always like, you know, like, the Civil War is so terrible, so bad. And you're like, those wars weren't any different. You know, like, they all have their impact on the national psyche.
Yeah, I've heard that where it's called, where it's just a series of, like, catastrophic wars, basically, where it's just one right after another, and it's just, you know, this change in identity mixed with a change in technology, and it just... It just comes together no matter where you are. And yeah, there are heightened numbers of casualties and there are, you know, what we would consider insurgencies in various ways. And it's just this era of deep seated revolution and civil war that we many times don't discuss because, one, for many people, sometimes it's just it's too difficult to discern the amount that's going on. And when you talk about things like Latin America, many people have not heard about that outside of Latin America, or people who study Latin America. We just aren't given that kind of information in our high school years or even our undergraduate years or anything like that. You have to find that yourself, right? And I think that's why comparative histories now and interdisciplinary scholarship is starting to gain more traction, because we're starting to see that there's a gap. And I don't know if you thought of that when you when you wrote the book and you were like, hey, this is filling this gap that we really need to, you need to look over here. basically, and look at this. Was that some of the mindset when you guys got together to decide to do this book?
Well, I'm going to start and give away a little
short
state
answer,
secret.
Yes.
Uh-oh. Yeah. I don't remember it. I think it was fairly late in the game as we were kind of sending in the second copy for the second round of peer review. And Duncan all of a sudden sent me a message and was like, "What do you think about bringing the military chapter up to the front?" Mm-hmm. And he made a good case. I will admit, yeah. Duncan made a really good case and said, you know, people want that hook. The military chapter would be a great hook to get people in. And I countered and I was like, yes, but the book is about nationalism. And the first chapter sets the nation states up. And that's what we needed. I think that was sort of a big... We don't want this book to be just a military history. The Civil War is a military event, but it's not just a military history.
Right.
And it is about the war being part of the reimagining of the nation. And kind of to your point there, John, I think that it's hard. Okay. I wish sometimes I had known what I know today about some of Latin America. It would have added interesting facets to the book. Mm-hmm. We didn't. there has been some interesting scholarship that has come out in the last 2 years that we couldn't integrate. I think it's still very niche. I still think that unless you speak Spanish, it will be very hard to get to. I think if we had spoken more languages, it would have and had a bigger research budget. It would have opened a lot more doors for us to kind of find a lot of great stories, even more comparisons. Of course, that would have probably made a 500-page book, and that was not the goal.
No, we actually went over the word count with the LSU press. So this book was longer than was intended. And yeah, it was one of these, Neil was right, it was one of these books. I mean, we knew what we wanted to look at. We just didn't realize what kind of can of worms we were going to be opening up. Because some of the things, at one point, for instance, I just wanted to do a little section on war correspondence, because there's photography from the Crimean War and reports from the Crimean War. This is also happening in the American Civil War. So like this idea of bringing the war to your living room, which was also new, not quite like Vietnam, the television war, but you're starting to see that, where the public are now getting pictures, photographs from the war, written, you know, articles live from the field to the Telegraph. And yeah, I mean, I just had to cut that out. There were a number of things we really would have liked to have added. The problem was not the shorts material. We actually had far too much in some ways. And yeah, with Niels, I'm still reading stuff that's coming out on religion and nationalism. Yes, I'd love to incorporate. But in fairness to us, nobody really has done this before, tried to like look at the American Civil War and compare it to all these other wars and events going on at the same time and attach the thematic issues, not just wars, Neil's pointed out, nationalism, religion, secession, realpolitik, memory. This was, as I say, a much bigger job than we were expecting, at least I expected. But yeah, we did start out to try emphasize the American Civil War really is a very important world historical event, but it's one of several world historical events and actually fits in and is very comparable to these other events going on at the same time contemporaneously.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by that idea, though, talking about mediatization of memory. That's what I'm studying right now. Mm-hmm. So this idea of photography and accounts that get out into whatever the mass media is of that time is in my wheelhouse. So I'm looking forward to you working further on that, because it might be on my comps list someday. I don't know. Niels, you were going to say something. I cut you off. I'm so sorry.
No, I was just going to say, like, you know, in the end, I think the biggest... Well, let me backtrack. When I was in grad school, I read a book about the origins of the Second World War debate debating A.G.P. Taylor's book. Apparently, I didn't read his actual book, but I read various essays of how he was wrong. And my professor kind of made a very good point that, you know, sometimes what really is the important part of your book is not all the things you say, but the conversations that you can start with it. And I think that's, in many ways, what we want with this book. We want there to be conversation. Like, you know, if we're wrong, show us how we are wrong. If you have more, we couldn't include it. You can, you know, write the next volume of this type of material, you know, and like we're very, very much we're on the same page. And I'll not bore you with the details of some of the editorial conversations we had regarding the introduction on having to explain transnational history, comparative history, issues we're taking with how we classified certain books with regard to exceptionalism. You know, I think that's the conversation we need, that what, like, we have too many exceptionalism books out there that treats the United States as, I think that was Duncan's words writing in the book, like, the United States being the sun the world orbits around. And that's not the case, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that would be a great live stream conversation someday, because I would just love to hear what people outside of us speaking would have to say in the chat about that, you know, where we would probably field some interesting takes. And I would love to have those, because we need to have those conversations, right? Where we need to say, you know, we need to chip away at that exceptionalism idea, that wall, and showcase the transnational and showcase the interdisciplinary, and because life is interdisciplinary and life is transnational. So, you know, it's like we said, it's not a vacuum. And that's what I appreciate about the book, was that it's detailed, but in the same way, it is also just the tip of the iceberg here. This is just touching it. And it's allowing people to have curiosity about maybe one section appeals to them, and they're like, I need to focus on, you know, Latin America and the American Civil War. Good, here, run. Here's the baton, run. Yeah. You know, or whoever else, and knowing people who I'm around in the post-secondary world, that's the kind of person that really, I'm with day in day out. We're like, I like this one chapter because it expresses this, and I didn't think of it this way, and I'm gonna run with it and see what happens. So someone, as you say, someone who speaks Spanish as a second language or even as a first language can look at that Latin American aspect of nationalism or identity and run with it. And that's the beauty of it. And all, you know, rising tide lifts all boats, right? We're all in this together in the end. So that's what I really admire about the work you two put together, is that it's an introductory, but yet it's a deep understanding or a deeper way of looking at this than some of us have been exposed to. And it also has a broad appeal because it is transnational and it is, you know, across all kinds of identities. So it touches a lot of bases in that way. And I greatly appreciated that from the, you know, interdisciplinary standpoint as well. But I would love to ask Duncan and Niels one last question.
I was going to ask you one.
Okay, ask me one. Go ahead. Turning you know, the table.
I'm usually the guy that asks the questions in these kinds of settings.
You are. Go ahead.
Knowing your interest in the First World War, I was curious. What did you thought about the conclusion of the book?
Yes. So Niels informed me that I need to read the conclusion first, which I have never done before. And I'm like, all right, let's try this. I really enjoyed it because, you know, it how should I say it? It checks some boxes for me that I had considered and yet not, with the idea of all these ideas coming together at one particular time and creating such a you know, it's kind of like when you're blowing up a balloon, you know, and all these ideas are starting to be ingested into this balloon, and then sooner or later it has to pop. And the ideas of culture coming together and colliding in a different way, again, with this idea of what is modern, coming together and in a different way. I really appreciated that in that, you know, half the people who study the First World War know about that kind of stuff. Half don't even know where the Balkans are. And it's just really interesting to see ideas that you would shape in the book coming to the 20th century in that light. It was interesting reading the conclusion first. But I understood why you told me to read it first, because you knew I was a First World War guy. And so it was kind of like, okay, here's the stuff that, John, you kind of understand. Okay, let's go back and find out where some of this stuff came from. Where the ideas of Germanic identity come from, and French, and et cetera, religion coming into play, and whose side is God on, and things like that. So I really appreciated the fact that you reached out to me, Niels, and told me to do something I've never done, which is read the conclusion first. Usually I go to the bibliography first. And I'm like, where's all this information coming from? I want to know what to read next. But I went to the conclusion because of your words. And I'll ask you, why did you tell me to go to the conclusion first?
Well, in part, because I knew you were a World War One historian. In part, I take no credit for the conclusion. That was all Duncan's work, actually. He wanted to do that way. And when I first read it, when I started reading that conclusion the first time he sent it to me, I kind of was like, what are you doing? but then as I kind of got through it, like you said, I was like, it ties everything we're doing together. The interesting part, why I kind of asked you to kind of see what you felt about it too, was because we had some pushback about whether we should do this type of conclusion or not. And that's why I kind of was like, I'm curious what John thinks. It will hook him because that's the material he really enjoys. But also kind of, I was curious what your thoughts would be with regard to it.
It definitely fit, Duncan. It definitely fit.
No, I would just add, it's funny. I defied an old professor's advice. She told me conclusions should just tell people what the book was about. That's it. Don't get clever. Just tell them what the book's about. And I started doing that and I got bored. And that's why I went off on this tangent, more or less, which I'm glad you enjoyed, John. But the other thing is, though, just on a personal note.
Oh, yeah.
My childhood, Woodrow Wilson was a great American president. Like, Woodrow Wilson was a genuinely great American president. And his reputation has dropped like a rock. And one thing I kind of found interesting when I was doing that conclusion, because he appears in it prominently, is this notion that national heroes, because that's something that comes up in the book, as with nation states, their reputations fluctuate quite staggeringly. And it's, again, if you're my age, Woodrow Wilson was a great president. Not so much anymore. And that was something that I just... that was a bit of part of it I really enjoyed writing, was just this fall from grace of, you know, what was a great man or was perceived to be a great man, which of course ties into national identity and the creation of our usable past.
Yeah. It's kind of the intersections that we see in life between history and cultural memory, right? And it's kind of those two things colliding once in a while where, sometimes I've had to ask people, you know, like online, I'm like, are you speaking history or cultural memory? That's two different things. Yeah. And you're right. Absolutely. And you two know, and obviously many of my listeners know that historical memory is fluid. It fluctuates. Mm-hmm. And each generation sometimes, or people within a generation, that idea of who a person was and what they did may change. You know, we talked about statues earlier. We talked about other things and memorialization and commemoration coming out of this era. That idea has changed in many cases, you know, as far as who should be and who shouldn't be. That's historical memory 101, right? And we're seeing it, especially in the conclusion, we're starting to see that generational shift in some of those ideas as well. I also learned early on in my life that Woodrow Wilson was a great guy. And then you saw the fall from grace happen for obvious reasons to many. Yeah. And I know that some of my seminar students laughed about him not being able to do the 14 points in his own nation, you know, and trying to pass it on to other people. So, yeah, that really is interesting. So I have one last question. One last question. One character, it's for each of you. One character out of this book who you think was one of the most influential.
Like historically most influential or in the writing the most influential?
At that time, who do you think?
At that time.
Yeah. Yeah. Who's influential at that time who you think that's the person that either you had to know more about or that you're like, this person has to be talked about more than just one chapter or one time or something. They were influential in different things.
Yeah, no, I'll go first. It's actually for me, not so much good or bad, but like just an enigma, is Louis Napoleon. I took more or less the British American view that this guy was a joke. And, you know, a bad joke at that. And, you know, it's Karl Marx's, oh, history repeats itself, first as tragedy, then as farce. Actually, no, he's a bizarrely influential figure, not the way he wants to be, but he actually kickstarts all sorts of things. We start off in the New York Herald complaining about him. And God forgive, but I'm actually on the side of the New York Herald on this occasion because he's a lot of the way, he's a source of so many things that go on in this book. And yet he's been kind of dismissed as this ridiculous figure. Mm-hmm. And in some ways he was far from ridiculous. In a lot of ways he did modernize France, transform it, but he made a lot of very, very bad decisions as well. And he is just a very, very strange figure. And I just found he was actually the figure who came for me in this book. He was the figure who was all of a sudden, don't treat this guy as a joke. Take him a bit more seriously because his contemporaries did, and they did so for a reason. It's only with hindsight we know what happens to him that we realize, okay, this was going nowhere. But for a while there, it looked like he was going to be the man of the age, more so than, say, Lincoln, which is also a reminder of history. It's 2020 hindsight. So that was one person I'd actually note would be Louis Napoleon of all people. Niels? Yeah.
Now you will see why we wrote the book together. Same guy. Yeah. For me, it's Louis Napoleon too. Probably for different reasons than Duncan, but I definitely agree with him where it's like you know, I said in a... I said at Ole Miss in a real big lecture hall, keynote speaker at the conference was a very prominent historian. I'm not going to say a name. You can look it up if you like. It's not that difficult to figure out. Who made this claim that Trump's not going to win. Hillary Clinton is going to win. Republican Party wouldn't support a clown like this. And they will go like reinvent themselves. And I had long before that kind of been like, no, clowns get elected, you know, weird people get elected. We can't dismiss it that easily. So I think in many ways, and Duncan reminded me a few times in the writing about it, that Louis Napoleon is elected by a larger body of people than anyone during this time or like in most elections in the world, you know, like, and he's popular. He has his fingers in everything. He has fingers in China, in Indochina, Vietnam. He has fingers in the Middle East. Yeah. He has his fingers in Africa, in South America, in European changes. I mean, the man is everywhere. For me, it's the age of Louis Napoleon III. Yeah. That's really the age. Bismarck, yeah, he arises, but it's after this period, the 1870s, 80s, that's the age of Bismarck, not this period. Sure, we could look at Lord Palmerston, but he's not as... he loses a lot of his edge as a result of the Crimean War. Louis Napoleon just is that like And I know you will probably have a lot of people now being like, oh, weird guys, you know, because he has such a bad reputation today in especially U.S. scholarship, which is not the case in France. There's a lot more balanced scholarship with regard to him there. But it's this kind of, I think something that rings very true to us today is that historians often ask this question, like, well, how did people in the U.S. at the time too, like, why would people vote somebody like this in and destroy their democracy? Well, they didn't. Democracy continued in France, and they looked at Napoleon as a bringer of stability, man that taking the country out of the instability, chaos of 1848, giving the country a new future. So for better and worse, I think he, if we don't take this man serious, we overlook a very important figure of this era.
Mm-hmm. Well, now I know who I need to read about more. because I've never read a dedicated biography on the man. So I know I have to go to the library.
You want to find a French one would be my suggestion.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that much French. I'll have to find a French, English translated French author version of it, because I only know a little German and Spanish. So I'm out with that. I've tried French. It's not good. So people in Quebec looked at me funny and I'm like, no, never mind.
That's a different world.
Well, that's cool. Sorry to everybody in Quebec. I'm in Canada. I can say sorry a lot now. Guys, this was a tremendous book to read. I really appreciate the fact that LSU Press got it to me quicker than it got it to Niels. And that's saying something. But it was a great book, and I really appreciated the time to speak with both of you across all the time zones. And I can't wait to see what's next from both of you. It's going to be interesting to see what people take from this book and understand that there is a larger context to many of these issues and a larger world around them at this time. And just like we live in the larger sphere. Yeah. And I'm really excited to hear the feedback, and we need to do a live stream on comparative history sometime.
Yeah. Totally. Thank you, John. We'll do that.
You're welcome. Yeah.
Thank you so
Niels
much.
Niels is like, I don't want to watch the chat. Niels is like,
well, that's what you're for.
I will watch the chat. We'll have a good time. Thank you guys for your time. I really greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, John. Thank you for having us.